Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
The FBI has turned over a list to the Justice Department of the FBI agents who worked on the January 6 rioters cases. Are you planning to fire the FBI agents who worked on those investigations?
No, but I'll fire some of them because some of them were corrupt. I have no doubt about that. I got to know a lot about that business, that world. I got to know a lot about that world, and we had some corrupt agents, and those people are gone or they will be gone, and it'll be done quickly and very surgically.
That was President Trump last Friday, making it clear that he does indeed plan to fire some of the FBI agents who worked on the investigations into the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6. Trump insists he understands the FBI quite well, and the targeted agents are, as he put it, corrupt, therefore justifying their quick dismissal from the ranks of federal law enforcement. Somebody else who knows the Bureau quite well is Chris O'Leary. He served for more than 20 years as a counterterrorism agent, winding up as the assistant special agent in charge of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York, where he actually worked January 6 cases himself. In the course of his career, he also worked directly with two key figures who will implement Trump's plans to fire the agents, Kash Patel, the president's nominee to head the bureau, and Emil Bove, one of Trump's former personal attorneys, who, with a new high-level perch at the Justice Department, is the enforcer overseeing the purge. O'Leary has some interesting things to say about both of them. I'm Michael Isikoff, and I'll talk to Chris O'Leary now on Spy Talk. Chris O'Leary, welcome to Spy Talk.
Good to be with you, Michael.
You had quite a career as a counterterrorism agent, working some pretty high-profile cases, some of which I want to talk to you about. But just to start out, tell us a little about how you came to work for the FBI, what drove you to want to be part of the Bureau, and tell us a little bit about your career.
Well, I'll tell you, I grew up in New York City, the son of a NYPD cop, with a family of NYPD police officers. So I think service in law enforcement was maybe in my blood for sure. But then probably, you know, something that surprised people, I didn't join the NYPD. I actually enlisted in the Marine Corps when I was 18 years old and went off to be a Marine for many years. And I'd say probably one of the biggest triggering events that got me interested in the Middle East and counterterrorism is in 1989. Part of the unit I was with, we responded to conduct contingency operations in Lebanon, and it was just another wave of violence going on there at the time, and Hezbollah had killed a Marine Lieutenant Colonel Higgins, who they had been holding hostage for a number of years, and they published a picture of him hanging, which was certainly horrific. But it was during the period where Hezbollah had been taking numerous American hostages, to include the CIA chief station, you know, Buckley and others. So really, you know, grabbed my attention, and I started reading on the topic. Then years later, when I got out of the Marine Corps, left active duty, I went back to school. I hadn't got my undergrad degree yet, and I went and got a degree in Middle Eastern studies with a minor in terrorism studies, which I went to Rutgers University for undergrad and learned Arabic. And then September 11th happened as I was graduating, and I came into the FBI.
And as a you worked some pretty high profile cases as a counterterrorism agent.
Yeah, so I had a kind of the benefit I did not get assigned to the New York office right out of the academy, which the funny part about that story is I put New York as my number one choice. Most people coming out of Quantico don't really want to go to New York unless you're from New York. I didn't process through the New York office, so that used to be a prohibition. You couldn't go back to the office you processed through, but I should have been able to come back to New York, and for whatever reason, I didn't. Well, my father, again, an NYPD cop, thought, well, I'll fix this because that's the way they do it in the NYPD. You just, you know, you have contracts with people and you arrange time. And he was going to reach out to the assistant director who he knew. And the assistant director at the time said, listen, Danny, my father, Dan O'Leary, we can certainly arrange that. You know, it's not hard to get orders come to the New York office, but we don't do it that way in the FBI, and he'll be somewhat of a marked man. And he's better off going where he got his orders to, which was Minneapolis, because he'll be able to get involved in things right away. And it turned out to be the case. I had cases waiting for me as soon as I reported, and I stumbled upon a pretty significant case pretty early on in my time up there with my detective partner from the Minneapolis Police Department, all under kind of the guidance of my training agent, unofficial training agent and mentor, Harry Samet, who was the guy who actually located and arrested Zacharias Massawi.
And was that was it the Massawi case were working on?
Yeah. We wound up doing a case on a guy by the name of Mohammed El Zahabi, who little is known about him because, you know, we never really were able to make the substantive charge in U.S. criminal court that we wanted. But he was probably the senior most Al-Qaeda first person we found in the United States after 9/11. He was, you know, kind of an OG member in the late 80s, you know, trained at the SADA camp, and then fought for years, was combat wounded in Afghanistan, came back to Brooklyn to convalesce. And he was part of kind of the first in generation of Al-Qaeda that went through Al-Farouq Mosque and the Al-Kifa Refugee Center in Brooklyn. And then came back here, convalesced, then went back to get into the fight. I mean, he was a really committed jihadist.
That was followed by some other big ones. I think you told me you were in Benghazi, you worked the Boston Marathon case.
Came to New York right in time for the Times Square bombing, right on the heels of the subway plot investigation. And then responded to Kampala, Uganda for the World Cup bombing. I did deploy into Benghazi with a special operations force as part of the crisis response, and then worked the cases with the New York Joint Terrorism Task Force for subsequent captures of the individuals that we know were responsible for the deaths of four Americans there. And
including the U.S. ambassador.
Including the U.S. ambassador.
For Stevens, yeah.
Yeah, the Boston bombing, I was part of the team that arrested Tsarnaev and did the interviews and interrogations of him afterwards. I was the senior person on scene when we captured him, and I actually physically took custody of him. But it was certainly, the entire city of Boston and all of the FBI was there present.
Right. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this episode is that, like, you understand and appreciate the culture of the FBI. So when you hear President Trump say, as he did the other day at a press conference, that he knows the FBI, he knows the world of the FBI, and some of the agents are corrupt, what goes through your mind and what do you think he's talking about?
I don't personally know what he's talking about, and I'm not questioning that the president believes in that, or he's felt attacked or singled out by maybe some people in the FBI. I have not encountered those people in my time. Every agent and, you know, task force officer partner that I worked with was the consummate professional, focused on the mission, and really dedicated to preventing the next September 11th. So I just haven't seen it. You know, some of the things that I've heard talked about that, you know, Kash Patel, if he gets confirmed as director, he wants to clear out FBI headquarters, make it less bureaucratic, I think you'll probably find overwhelming support throughout the FBI for that, because the FBI has become very bureaucratic, and I've seen it grow over time in my 2+ decades of work in the matter, and it became very hierarchical and, you know, difficult for agents to be able to do their job without asking permission to do simple things. So I think streamlining some of the bureaucratic processes, reducing the size of headquarters, and pushing the focus of effort back to a special agent on the street working a case, that would be welcomed. But I really don't know where the deep state allegations are, because it's just not the FBI that I know.
Yeah. And I should say that the idea of getting agents at headquarters out into the field is not a new one. I mean, I remember, you know, back in the day, Louis Freeh talking about that when he came in. So that's been a long-running theme. But what we're talking about, and at least a lot of the rhetoric coming from the president and some of the people he's filling his administration with, is different. I mean, they seem to believe that there's a bunch of liberal deep state activists who are out to sabotage Trump's presidency. I've covered the FBI for many years, and I have to say that was not my image of the Bureau as an institution over the years. If anything, the Bureau was viewed as a sort of bastion of conservatives, mostly Republican, not exclusively, but that was the image of the Bureau. Give me a sense from your experience of how much of a role politics and people's political thinking played into how FBI agents did their job.
Well, first thing I'll say, I think your assessment of, you know, where most FBI agents lean is accurate. It's probably a little further to the right than, you know, than middle of the road, for sure.
Than the news media, perhaps. But yeah.
But politically, where do FBI agents shake out? I have no idea, because it's like a good Irish pub. No politics and no religion. You don't talk about those things at work. Nobody cares. Nobody wants to hear any of those things. I cannot remember a single incident standing around talking about politics in the FBI. It just doesn't exist. If we
you were in the FBI for like more than 20 years, right?
Yeah. That's not,
and you're saying never a political conversation in all that time?
Not something you particularly care about. It's not considered appropriate. And yeah. You know, if we're standing around, we're either talking about investigations, planning operations or arrests, or, you know, not to be cute, but probably throwing quotes, movie quotes out at each other from Goodfellas or, you know, yeah. Pick Up Me or Godfather. But there's not a lot of standing around, you know, wondering what's going on in Washington. And you know, I think, you know, self-important people in Washington think a lot of people are standing around talking about them. We have a job to do that we committed ourselves to. And, you know, I never tried to sound dramatic to the people that I worked with or that worked for me, but you have an obligation, a serious obligation to do your job and do it well and not be just pretty good at it, because you have to prevent the next 9/11. So if you're standing around BSing about politics, you're not actually doing your job.
The Washington Post had a piece on Sunday reporting that two FBI agents in field offices were being interviewed for top positions, and they were asked questions that included, who were the real patriots on January 6th? Who won the 2020 election? Who is your real boss? What do you make of questions like that?
Yeah, so I've heard that as well. I haven't been able to confirm it yet, but if that's the case, it's going to be a dark day for this country. I mean, the FBI and the Department of Justice needs to remain independent and away from politics. They need to be able to carry out their core missions, which are counterterrorism, counterespionage, political corruption cases, to protect the democracy. And what we have to make sure is that the FBI doesn't become just another secret police. That an administration, whether it's this one or a future one, can use as it's Stasi or KGB. That's not who FBI agents are. FBI agents are supposed to be protecting the Constitution and our citizens.
So let's get right down to some of the current controversy. You were in charge, you were the assistant special agent in charge of the Joint Terrorism Task Force in New York towards the end of your career. And you yourself worked January 6 cases. And one in particular kind of leaps out. I believe you may have helped make the arrest, Samuel Fisher. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so I was the assistant special agent in charge at the time, the ASAC. And after January 6th, like every field office in the country, we started receiving leads about people who committed acts there, some of which were self-identifying. So Samuel Fisher put posts out before January 6th about what he was going to do, telling people to bring guns. It was going to be 1776 all over again. And then after, talking about how beautiful it was, you know, the violence that they were committing on police officers. So, I mean, he really kind of self-admitted his actions there. We were concerned based on other posts that he had made that, you know, he was a continued risk of violence. He had made some indications that, you know, there was going to be some other violent activity. We located him on the Upper East Side in Manhattan on January 20th. And I assigned the lead out, the case out, to our threat response squad, because our domestic terrorism squad was already saturated with other cases, which will surprise some to hear, many of which were Antifa cases that came out of, you know, the previous, you know, protests and riots and everything else. So we were working both sides, which, you know, is inconvenient for this other narrative. But you know, my threat response squad handled the case. They located him. We got legal process to be able to arrest him, take him into custody. And then the one thing I'll tell you is when we assign the case to a squad, I don't know if it's going to an FBI agent or if it's going to a task force officer from another agency, because the New York Joint Terrorism Task Force was created in 1980 with 10 FBI agents and 10 NYPD detectives. And it was really in response to a series of domestic terrorism incidents in and around the city, which included the bombing of Francis Tavern, the Brinks armored car robbery. So a variety of things. So FALN, Black Liberation Army, domestic terrorism incidents. It grew over time. The New York Joint Terrorism Task Force at the time of January 6th was comprised of roughly 450 members from about 50 different agencies, including 130 NYPD detectives. So when we assign out a case, your lead case agent could be a 25-year NYPD detective with maybe or maybe not a FBI agent as the co-case. So as we're looking for lists of people that were involved in January 6th arrest, it's not just FBI agents. It could be right. Any.
So when they arrest, when your people arrested this guy, Samuel Fisher, who, by the way, was a dating coach, I believe was his profession.
What, he
was
coach?
Coaching men on how to pick up women is what I gather. But they find, your folks found, thousands of rounds of ammunition, weapons, including a illegally modified AR-15, machetes, a ghost gun, unregistered and untraceable. I mean, this was a dangerous guy.
It was. And he was a ardent believer in QAnon conspiracies and unstable. And he was following a false narrative that was really mobilizing him towards violence.
And of course, one reason I'm particularly interested in him is because, look, you're an FBI agent, but ultimately it's federal prosecutors who are going to make the decisions about charging people. And there was a particular prosecutor you were working with on that and other January 6 cases. And when I heard who it was, it kind of leapt out at me right away. Tell us who it was.
And so I think you're referring to the now, ADAG, the Assistant Attorney General, Emil Bovet, who I knew well from his time in Southern District of New York. He was a really terrific partner, to just be frank. Good lawyer, very good partner. The New York Joint Terrorism Task Force and the New York office as a whole is incredibly fortunate to have the Southern District of New York was located right next door. It's now actually embedded in the same building. And the Eastern District of New York, which is the Brooklyn prosecutors right across the Brooklyn Bridge. So incredibly close partnership in everything that we do. As a matter of fact, their investigators for counterterrorism sit with the FBI agents and task force officers in our space.
So do you remember talking to Bovet about either the Fisher case or any of the January 6 cases?
So I don't recall a specific conversation point to point with them, but I will tell you all of the January 6 cases were priority at the time. And everything that we did was transparent to the entire task force. And we ran a weekly leadership meeting where in our joint operations center, where all the leadership from the different agencies, which included Southern District of New York and the other U.S. Attorney's Office, they were all present there. And we would go through, whether it's surveillance operations, arrest operations, investigative updates. So he would be privy to all of that information.
He would be, or he was. I mean, he was there. He was overseeing. Okay. All right. Look, this kind of blows my mind because Emil Bovet is now like the number three person in the Justice Department. And he's the guy who's the enforcer of the edicts to get rid of these FBI agents who work January 6 cases. He ordered the FBI to turn over the names of everybody who worked on January 6 cases, presumably so they can decide who is going to be fired. And yet you're telling me that he was overseeing January 6 cases himself when he was at the Justice Department.
That's accurate. And I would also go further to say that if he had any concern, any objection, he never voiced it. Or if he witnessed any violation of due process or any violation by an FBI agent or task force officer, he would have had an obligation to report it, none of which was done.
So having worked with him on January 6 cases, how do you feel seeing him playing this role as the guy who's going to get rid of FBI agents who worked January 6 cases?
So it's somewhat surprising. Again, he was a good partner and he was a good lawyer, and he established some really strong relationships with the New York Joint Terrorism Task Force, to include with Brian Driscoll and Rob Kassane, who he knows well from that period of time.
The two top guys at the FBI right now.
Acting director and acting deputy director. I would not have expected this from him. Not the one, the Emil that I knew back in 2021. And I'm somewhat disappointed in his lack of integrity and hypocrisy.
I'm disappointed. Yeah, you were a little stronger when we spoke the other day.
It's outrageous that he is going to turn on the people that were his teammates just a few short years ago.
Yeah. And you feel what seeing this?
Listen, I think I'm now retired, but, mm-hmm. I speak to agents and detectives nonstop for the last week and a half, and they feel betrayed and they feel persecuted and concerned about, what happens to them and their families moving forward. And it's they're very uneasy across the entire service.
And is it the edict, the demand for the list, which I think goes up into the thousands of people who worked agents, who worked January 6 cases, is that, or is it even bigger than that?
Well, I think it's the
concerns.
list, number one, which is, could just be the tip of the iceberg, and that's the concern. You don't know what's going to happen next. So, the concern that I have is people are just going to leave. So anybody who's eligible for retirement probably just, will just leave, right? Just out of self-protection. They'll raise their hand, they'll take their retirement, and they'll try to get out before something happens to them, or before they're fired overnight, which, is what happened to some of the senior leaders. But if you go further down, unless you are kind of past your halfway point, or you can see your retirement and your pension within your sights, more junior agents may go as well. Because if it's a coercive environment where you can't do your job, where you could be facing punitive action for just doing your job at any point in your career, well, it might not be the place or the culture you want to continue to commit yourself to. And that the United States without an FBI is we're in greater danger.
Another guy you worked with in the course of your career and got to know was Kash Patel, who was the president's nominee to take over the FBI. And of course, he's quite controversial himself. Tell us about your own experiences with him.
Yeah, this surprises a lot of people. I know Cash, in 2010, there was a horrific bombing by global jihadists in East Africa in Kampala, Uganda during the World Cup, which killed many, but including one American. The New York Joint Terrorism Task Force responded over to the crime scene and to also aid the Ugandans in conducting their investigation because their capabilities were very rudimentary. So the way I like to describe it is it was almost like what the military special forces do, foreign internal defense, kind of. We served as advisors but also ran a parallel case. So really building them up to run their own investigation, help illuminate the network and find the people responsible, help them prepare their prosecution, all the while we were running a parallel case just in case they failed. So a good number of us were went over there. Rob Kassane, the acting deputy director, was over there with me. And I worked it for a while, but I was running the Al-Qaeda squad at the time. And this was really not in my lane to stay with. So, I worked it for a bit and then went back to my core functions because actually we had the Bin Laden case assigned to my squad. So that coming up soon too. But Cash got involved in it as a prosecutor at Main Justice at a certain point and started establishing relationships with Rob Kassane, a number of the other agents in leadership, and some of the detectives on the squad. And, he was widely considered a good partner and a good lawyer, really built some good relationships, was good working with the interagency, the different parts of the US government that we needed to partner with. And then I kind of started working with them again after Benghazi. When we started putting together the cases then. Again, he was not the lead attorney on any of it, but he served a pretty important kind of coordinator role with Main Justice. And again, I would say he was a decent human being, decent partner, and I would if that individual, if I didn't see him again or didn't hear anything about him again, and he showed up at the Senate confirmation hearings, and then day one at the FBI, he would have been received well by me and by, I think, anybody in the FBI.
But he's had a quite a different career path since those days. And, he was promoting, he put together the January 6th choir performances, called the January 6th defendants, who you and others helped arrest as political prisoners who were holed up in the DC gulag. And he's made quite a few provocative comments along those lines. How do you square the Kash Patel you knew with the Kash Patel we now see all the time on TV and read about? And what do you make of having him in his current incarnation head the bureau that you worked for so many years?
Yeah, so it gives, gives me pause for sure. And I think that's really a polite way to put it. But I've been a little bit on an emotional roller coaster. I try to be optimistic about things. And people ask, well, is he qualified? I would argue that he's as qualified as Director Wray and Director Comey and even Director Mueller and Director Free, because their qualifications for the FBI came out of this modern standard that you have DOJ experience. And though his was not as substantive as theirs, he still had 3 years. And so he's basically qualified, right?
Mueller was a U.S. attorney and assistant attorney general. Chris Wray headed the criminal division of DOJ.
But the standard, that you're an attorney and now you're going to lead a nearly 40,000 person investigative and operational and force and intelligence capability that is dispersed around the country and globally dispersed. I mean, at any given point, the FBI is operating in 100 countries, is really, to a lot of us, maybe not the best standard. And maybe having somebody with some more operational experience or field experience might have been good to have. But putting that aside, the political theater that he's carried out in the last few years, going back to what we talked about earlier, that should not mix with the FBI. I can tell you it didn't in my time at the FBI. I just never saw it. Now the concern is being brought in from the outside. It's politicizing the FBI, something that's being alleged that doesn't really exist, but you're actually going to inject it into the FBI. So that's me up until a couple of weeks ago. And then his confirmation hearing happens, and I actually thought he did pretty well, although he certainly wasn't completely forthcoming on all of his answers. I didn't think he did miserably or like was really that concerning in a lot of the things he said. And then, there was this indication that he was going to surround himself with the Brian Driscolls of the world, the Rob Kassin, right, Carlos Fernandez, Steve Reese, all guys that I came up with. Excellent leaders, very operationally focused.
Didn't Carlos Fernandez, I thought he'd left the bureau.
And he did. They're
Verizon
all
Verizon or something, right? Yeah.
So they're all those guys retired, but there was this idea that they'd bring them back as special advisors. Mm-hmm. If Cash was going to do that, maybe that was going to mitigate some of the concerns that I and others might have with him. He's going to surround himself with really good people, good leaders, good mentors who can lead up and help, renovate the FBI.
So you're willing to give him a break?
I was until Friday happened.
And then what happened on, what are you referring
Friday,
to?
Friday, then Emil started asking for the list, and now—
Got it.
Now we know that whether, Cash gets through or somebody else, that there's going to be this kind of move from the White House to, take coercive moves toward the FBI and look to control it.
You mentioned Brian Driscoll, who I gather you worked with quite closely as well. He's now, of course, the acting director of the FBI, and he's the guy who's been standing up to Emil Bove and refusing to turn over the list of names of agents who worked on the January 6th cases. What's your take on him and whether he's got a future once Patel comes in and takes over his job.
Yeah, I think that's the problem. So the others, Rob Kassane is the acting deputy director, and right. James Dennehy is the assistant director of the New York office. They've all kind of held the line together. They're all terrific agents with amazing reputations. Without going into details, all of them have worked extensively overseas with our special operations partners in Iraq, Afghanistan, North Africa, mm-hmm. East Africa, on the front lines in counterterrorism. And they're just exceptional individuals without a political bone in their body. And they're just demonstrating the leadership you would expect, and that, frankly, the American people should demand from somebody in that position. They have integrity, they have virtue, they have sound judgment, and really, the simple concept I learned as a young Marine, and James Dennehy was a fellow Marine, Rob Kassane went to West Point, is as a leader, you're responsible for two primary things. Number one, mission accomplishment. Like, that's your responsibility. And when we're working counterterrorism, or now more broadly, making sure the FBI can conduct its entire mission, they're trying to make sure that continues to happen. But the other thing is the welfare of your people. What kind of leader are you if you're not looking out for your people? And the three of them are demonstrating that in an exceptional way. And really, I think, leading by example, leading from the front, and setting an example for others to follow.
Got it. Look, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Chris O'Leary about the nature of the terrorism threat facing the country today and how effective the U.S. government's efforts to combat it have been. And we're back with Chris O'Leary, former chief of the Joint Terrorism Task Force for the FBI in New York. Chris, I want to ask you about a really fascinating interview you gave to the West Point Combating Terrorism Center a few months ago, because you had a lot of really provocative things to say. But before I do, one more item on the Trump agenda I need to ask you about. I don't know. You mentioned early in your career, you worked Hezbollah cases in Lebanon. One of the things the new Trump team has done is strip certain individuals like former National Security Advisor John Bolton and former Joint Chiefs Chief Mark Milley of their security protection, despite the fact that they're believed to be targets of Iranian assassins in the United States. I'm told that this is still very much an active threat. What do you make of the fact that the president has stripped people who are potential targets of these Iranian assassins?
So I don't know the updated intelligence briefing that the president or any other senior leaders in the administration are getting about the nature of the threat right now. I do know the origins of the threat, and I do know the legitimacy of the threat, having, when I was special agent in charge in New York, I had an Iranian threat squad that worked these exact matters. So I know the details of the threat very well, which is why they had the security details in the first place, which is why they got routine briefings from the FBI on an ongoing basis. Where it is right now, I can't speak to it. I do know that, nobody's going to get a security detail for the rest of their life. So, in the reasonableness side, I get that. But if the threat level is still anywhere near what it used to be, we have an obligation to protect these people who were exposed to that threat while they were serving the United States. And it's our responsibility to make sure that they're protected and their families protected. And Hezbollah, although they've been weakened, and the Iranians, the IRGC, is certainly on their heels a little bit now, too. Those two organizations have demonstrated historically their ability to conduct operations overseas over time. They are normally not reactionary. they're more deliberate and trying to seek retribution. And there's a number of cases of that.
Right. And they are seeking retribution, we are told, because of the order by President Trump to assassinate Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, back when Trump was president the first time. I mentioned that West Point Combating Terrorism Center interview you gave back in October of last year. And there's a number of things you said that really leapt out at me. And I'm going to read some of them to you, and I want you to explain. You were talking about October 7th, the Hamas attack on Israel. You said October 7th has unfortunately demonstrated that hostage taking works and terrorism as a tactic works. Hamas is more or less was more or less a local movement on October 6th, and now the Palestinian cause is a global movement once again. So my concern is, as 9/11 becomes more distant in our rearview mirror and we pivot towards great power competition, our terrorist adversaries are looking at Hamas's recent success and are inspired by it. Make no mistake, ISIS is surviving and enduring. Al-Qaeda, which almost nobody outside the CT community talks about, was roughly 500 members before September 11th, but has swelled its ranks now to many times that size and is in two dozen countries around the world. So despite our over two decades of fighting terrorism, the problem is worse, not better. Tell us why.
Yeah, it's one of those things we should sleep with one eye open, to reference a Metallica song. It's the problem is much worse, and it's, so, you know, my entire career was working terrorism, counterterrorism. And even though I was a very operational guy, I'm really at heart an academic who just incessantly studies this stuff and reads about it. And terrorism in the modern era goes back to the mid 1800s. Felice Orsini was an Italian anarchist who used what became the Orsini bomb to try to assassinate Napoleon III. He failed, but the concept of terrorism as a tactic, political violence, spread like wildfire across the anarchist community, as did the modern technology of the Orsini bomb, which was the equivalent of a rudimentary hand grenade. And subsequent to that attempted attack, and he became a bit of a celebrity before he was put to death, 10 heads of state were assassinated by anarchists over subsequent decades, including President McKinley. So it was demonstrative of the fact that you could use this asymmetric tactic as a weaker individual or group or adversary and strike the more powerful. And that you could use this new technology, which is the Orsini bomb, to level the playing field. And that's going back quite a bit. But that has continued in the modern era. So
why is the problem worse today than it was, 10, 15 years ago?
So after
9/11.
After the fall of the Soviet Union, before the fall of the Soviet Union, you had terrorist organizations kind of broken down into three different groups. You had those inspired by ideology, Marxist-Leninist groups like the Red Brigades, the Red Army faction, Shining Path, right? Mostly supported by the Soviet Union and others. You had ethno-nationalist movements. You can throw Ba'ath separatists, ETA, into that. The different Palestinian movements, going back to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, all the way up to PLO, Hamas, and a number of others. Even though Hamas has got a Islamist spin to it, they are primarily just an ethno-nationalist movement. And then you had the religiously motivated groups, which were more rare before the fall of the Soviet Union. Al-Qaeda was really one of the first prominent ones, but yet you had you might remember the Aum Shinrikyo, subway attack in Tokyo. They were kind of religiously motivated. And you've had some others over the years. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the problem became simpler. And then after September 11th happened, it became even simpler. None of the ethno-nationalist movements really were engaging in violent action because they didn't want to be thrown in the same bucket as Al-Qaeda by carrying out bombings or acts of violence. So you saw bombings and other political violent actions reduce quite a bit. And it only really became the global jihadist movement, right? So that was, you know, we should have been able to get a handle on things. But because of the way we responded to Afghanistan and then into Iraq and other places, and we really just tried to address the problem with hard power, with military force, and few other tools, their movement actually grew in strength over time. So us invading into Iraq created Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which over time turned into ISIS. Us moving into Afghanistan and really reducing the capabilities of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan changed their kind of playbook, and they started concentrating on their affiliates. Those affiliates, where we didn't have that much of a presence, continued to spread. ISIS actually replicated that model. So, you know, you go across Africa is a great place to look, and you have affiliates of ISIS and Al-Qaeda spread throughout Africa, because Africa's good portions of it are defined by failed states, semi-failed states, and ungoverned space. That's where these groups thrive, and we have no ability to really counter it right now.
One comment you made, which I quoted from in that interview and is very relevant right now, you said October 7th has unfortunately demonstrated that hostage taking works. We've all seen, you know, the images from the last few days of those gaunt, emaciated hostages being returned by Hamas to Israel after a propaganda, you know, scenario by Hamas. And this is a, and by the way, having talked to senior people in the Justice Department in recent years, they have steadfastly been against the return, making deals with terrorists to return hostages for the very reason that it encourages them. What does the West do? What does the United States do? What should the Israelis do? What should any Western country do with when there's these gut-wrenching hostage-taking that, you know, generates, as we've seen in Israel, enormous popular demand, bring the hostages home, cut a deal, cut a deal. Where do you come down if you're saying what this demonstrates is hostage-taking works?
Yeah, so first of all, the U.S. policy saying we don't make concessions is frankly just not true. We say that, but we've made concessions time and time again. And
yeah.
I'll point to
after, we could deal with the Russians, you know, right? Or,
after we withdrew from Afghanistan, there was an American who was left behind there, Mark Frericks, and we had few capabilities to be able to do a rescue and recovery. We had limited intelligence collection capability, and he was being held by the Haqqani network in particular. During negotiations, the Haqqanis and core Taliban asked on over, I think it was over 40 times, asked for the exchange of an individual, Haji Bashir Nourzai, who was arrested here in New York City, kind of on narco-terrorism charges. It's really no better way to explain that. But the background of Haji Bashir Nourzai, why they were asking for him, he was the head of the largest tribe in southern Afghanistan. He fought in the 1980s against the Soviets as a mujahideen, and it was his fighting force that Mullah Omar joined. So he was kind of an old school guy. He was an original member of the Taliban Shura Council, and he was also in charge of the area where most poppy was produced from, which is a revenue stream for now the fledgling government and new Taliban government in Afghanistan. And the way he was described in the mid-2000s was, you know, he's the El Chapo of Afghanistan. And I think that's a good comparison.
And well, we let him go as part of the deal?
We had ongoing discussions with the previous administration and with members of Congress. And the direction that I was given was, we'll tell, you know, the Taliban and Haqqanis we don't do exchanges. The problem was the people who were in those conversations were two individuals in particular that are worth pointing out. Anas Haqqani and Mullah Muhammad Fazil. We exchanged for both of them in two separate deals, one for Bo Bergdahl, where we exchanged the Getmo 5, which Mullah Muhammad Fazil was about, and then an American and Australian King in Weeks, where we exchanged for Anas Haqqani. So we cannot tell them with a straight face that we don't make exchanges because they know we do. And ultimately, we got the authority to make the exchange and we got Mark Ferrix home. And we returned Hajib Shir Norzai, who had served 3/4 of his sentence. I felt terrible for the FBI agents and DAA agents who made a great case, but we had no other way to recover him. And I would say having a policy that is really transparent and something that we could truly execute, but has maximum flexibility based on any individual situation, based on the group, based on the time, based on a threat to the hostage. I mean, I wouldn't want to do an exchange with JNIM, which is Al-Qaeda in the Sahel, because they've turned hostage taking into a business.
That, with who, I'm sorry?
JNIM. JNIM is the Al-Qaeda affiliate in the Sahel in North Africa. They've been taking hostages professionally for a long time. And people pay and get the release of their citizens. Americans have been taken hostage by them, but by accident. They know we don't pay. But if we started paying, they'd start taking more hostages. So I wouldn't encourage any kind of concession or exchange with them. But there are some groups, going back to what really changed the hostage policy in the United States, ISIS from a decade ago, you know, a lot of other foreign partners made exchanges and deals with ISIS and got their citizens exchanged. The Americans that were taken were all beheaded because we took a hard stance against ISIS. And although our special operations forces were actively hunting for the hostages, and I'll tell you, including Brian Driscoll going out on one of the rescue operations, which is in court records. You know,
rescue operations where?
Brian Driscoll tried to rescue Kayla Mueller as part of a special operations rescue area. He provided evidence in the trial against the Beatles, Alexander Cote and Shafi El Sheikh. So tells you what who Brian Driscoll is.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Kayla Mueller was not able to be saved.
Well, it's a pretty sobering assessment, I have to say, that you've given us on the terrorism front and unfortunately about the state of the FBI as well. But it's something I think people need to hear. So, Chris O'Leary, I really want to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating discussion, and we hope to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Okay, thank you. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. I mean, Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, high up MAGA guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.